Scientific discovery is an engine of economic and military power, and America has long prided itself on its leadership in research. But as astrophysicist Neil Tyson points out, there are some dark clouds on the horizon. Tyson says scientific research in America is clearly in a state of decline compared to other regions like Asia and Western Europe. As everyone else understands the value of innovative investments in science and technology in ways that we do not, says Tyson, we slowly fade. Is America still a can-do nation, or has there been a decline in our approach to science? I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
How have we changed our views on science and exploration since we landed a man on the moon? What effect does it have on science in America that a large percentage of us in this country do not believe in evolution or global warming? Why has the National Institutes of Health cut its support for biomedical research by 22% from what it was a decade ago? Joining us to explore the topic, is America still a can-do nation? The erosion of support for science, is Alan Addy, professor of biochemistry at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Welcome back to University of the Air.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be back.
I look forward to exploring this topic of, I guess you'd say, the edge and whether America has lost it when it comes to science and exploration in general. It seems historically that there's nothing like a war to get America motivated when it comes to scientific innovation. In the case of landing a man on the moon, of course, it was the Cold War. Do you perceive that as a part of the problem today? Is the edge lost because the sense of urgency is lost?
Well, I don't really want to advocate for another war. I don't think it's just that. That might have been part of it, because certainly Sputnik was a catalyst for Kennedy to launch a massive space program. But I think there was a lot more to it than that. I think that at that time we had a sense of ourselves as a can-do nation. We had a sense of ourselves as a country that was just incredibly innovative and hardworking and full of talent and a sense of purpose. And so he, I think, appealed to that when he made his speech, his famous speech, where he said, let's put a man on the moon. And he didn't have to go into a lot of detail about practical benefits that would come out of that. In fact, there was no way at that time that he or anybody else could predict what all the practical spin-offs would be. And of course, we all know that the computer revolution that we have today was, to a pretty great extent, a spin-off of the space program. But he didn't know that, and he didn't need to know that in order to get everybody on board. In fact, if I can quote from him, he said, "We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do other things, not because they're easy, but because they are hard, because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills, because that challenge is one that we are willing to accept, one we are unwilling to postpone, and one which we intend to win and the others too." When was the last time we heard anybody, any leader, say that?
And are you saying that part of President Kennedy's approach there is just a general idealism, sort of a sense of America as a place of possibility? That, and if we've lost that, why do you think we've lost it?
I think we've lost it for a number of reasons. One is that there's developed a cynical attitude towards government. And obviously, only government can do something on this scale, on the scale of a space program. It's not something that a private company can take on. It's not something that individuals can take on. This was a very, very large endeavor. And so we now are embarked on a debate that goes on every year about whether or not government should do anything at all beyond just the ordinary functions of police and fire protection and fighting wars. And I feel like that's been very damaging to the country, because now we can't talk about ambitious projects. We can't talk about a unified goal. I think also there's been a political polarization that existed certainly in Kennedy's day. The parties were divided, but they weren't divided about these things. There wasn't, when he said, let's put a man on the moon, you didn't have people from the opposite political parties feel like they had to oppose it because he proposed it. They just got behind it, and the whole country rallied behind it. And so there was this tremendous sense of adventure and excitement throughout the 60s. All those Gemini missions, all those spacecraft, you know, circling the Earth and then eventually circling the moon and then finally culminating in Neil Armstrong setting foot on the moon. The whole country was excited about it, and there were no political divisions, you know, in the response to it.
So you think that's one issue, this polarization of government. What other factors do you see as making us lose our edge when it comes to scientific curiosity and innovation?
I think another one is that science itself has lost some of its authority, in the sense that when science began to deliver bad news that was contrary to a lot of interests, such as on issues like pollution and climate change, and way back, starting with the scientific consensus on the supersonic jet, which Nixon wanted to initiate, there has been a strong attempt to delegitimize science, and to the point where now you hear people say, "Well, science is just an opinion," and to a scientist, that's anathema. To hear somebody say science is just an opinion is to delegitimize a way of knowing, evidence-based knowledge.
Well, or they might say science is just a theory. I mean, people are still saying that about things from evolution to climate change.
Well, that phrase, just a theory, is a charged phrase, because a scientific theory is not just a theory. A scientific theory is something that is based on quite a bit of evidence. And whereas in ordinary language that doesn't refer to science, when somebody says just a theory, it means that it may or may not be true. But scientific theories are something that are as close as we get to fact. You know, we say the theory of gravity. The Earth being a sphere is a theory.
Is it?
But
I mean, isn't there such a thing as proving a theory and then it becomes fact rather than theory?
In the strictest sense, we never say we prove a theory. We say we fail to disprove it. And somebody could probably conjure up some crazy notion of how we could maybe one day discover that the Earth is flat. But strictly speaking, everything is theoretical in the sense that we, as scientists, try to maintain the idea that if we're going to be evidence-based, we should always be prepared for contrary evidence.
But some theories are farther out there than others.
Of course.
It's a big term.
Well,
certainly.
And also, in all fairness to those who become skeptical about science as a field of authority, scientists keep changing their mind, too. I mean, that's part of the history of science or the history of medicine. And we see it in our own times where we're told, you know, this is what you should take for your health. And then the following year it comes out, well, it turns out there's some terrible side effect, or maybe women have a different dose, or, you know, every day there's an article in the newspaper that sort of disproves some other.
Or even the shift from global warming to climate change.
Well, that's just playing with words. But
is it really? I mean, because global warming implies, you know, at least a kind of a steady warming, whereas climate change means lack of stability, which might ultimately lead to warming, but in certain cases could lead to cooling, right? I mean, isn't there a difference in those two?
Well, I think that the use of those terms is more of a marketing scheme than anything else. It's kind of like when there were a good example is when there was a so-called debate on cigarette smoking. The spokespeople for the tobacco industry never said cigarettes. They said tobacco products.
How interesting.
And they were trained to do that. They never, ever said cigarettes. But what they were able to do was to convince the media that there were two sides to this issue that were equally deserving of equal time, even though there was an absolute consensus in science that cigarettes cause cancer. There was just no doubt that they cause cancer. But they seeded the doubt, and they continued to seed the doubt for many, many, many years, until finally The Smoking Gun came out, which was their own internal documents, where they obviously acknowledged that cigarettes caused cancer and that they were killing off 400,000 of their customers every year and needed to target children in order to get new customers.
Well, and so where did we cross a line, assuming you could even define it, from where science had this credibility to where science was consistently viewed as just conjecture?
Well, there's a book called The Republican War on Science that's a history of that. And according to that writer, I forgot his name, it began actually in the post-Nixon years when members of Congress decided to abolish the Office of Technology Assessment, which was a nonpartisan organization that would draw from the scientific community to provide expertise on matters of science. They would draw from the very best people. And industry lobbyists decided that they didn't like this organization because they too often came out saying things that were contrary to their interests. So they created a lot of so-called think tanks and institutes that had the sound of an academic institution, but they really weren't. And then they would demand equal time in congressional hearings to field their experts. And then they would say, you know, we have our experts, you have your experts. They deserve equal time. Mm-hmm. Very much like what the tobacco industry did to obfuscate and to make it seem like the cigarette issue is still up in the air.
So you could say democracy has its weaknesses when it comes to equality.
Well, science is not democratic in the sense that when there are disagreements about a particular scientific matter, usually people can agree on what experiment can be done to resolve the difference. And so to that extent, there's a consensus, even though until the experiment is done, there might be wide disagreements. After the experiment is done and supports one view versus another, we move on. So, you know, in the early days before Watson and Crick, there were several models for the three-dimensional structure of DNA. Then Rosalind Franklin came out with the X-ray crystallography structure, and that ended the argument. It was a double helix. It had sugars on the inside, phosphates on the outside. Linus Pauling had the opposite view, but he abandoned it the very day he saw the evidence. And nobody ever goes back and argues the other way because the definitive experiment was done, and now we move on. And that's the progressive nature of science. So in that sense, it's not democratic.
Well, what about the point I raised earlier about the sort of negative consequences sometimes that come out later? A good example might be X-rays, where X-rays would be done sometimes in shoe stores of children's feet or just routinely in dentist's office without giving it a thought. And only later does it come out about the carcinogenic effect of radiation. So sometimes if science or an advance or technology is hailed as a panacea or something exciting, it seems to be followed a little later, whether it's DDT or Agent Orange or radiation, with the negatives.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, everything I said doesn't mean scientists don't get things wrong or aren't irresponsible or don't produce things that poison the environment or cause harm. That's absolutely right. But what corrects those things is science. Again, science that says X-rays are harmful, science that says thalidomide is bad for you. So it's still self-correcting, but it doesn't mean it's not ever wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Of course it's wrong, and you have to have error in any endeavor like this because it's done by human beings, and human beings make mistakes of interpretation. Scientists are biased. They're still human beings, and they're still as flawed as all other human beings.
Well, what if we look at one of the, you've already mentioned this, most visible aspects of American science, which is the space program. There was one thing to get a man 250,000 miles to the moon. But the next stepping stone is a long way and lots of money away. It's this asymptotic number. It goes up very radically when you go to Mars, for example. Is that part of the problem with the space program, do you think? That other things, if you have a space station just going around the Earth, experimenting with plants and gravity, it's just not as exciting to the public, is it, as putting boots on a different planet?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true, that it appeals to the imagination. But I'd like to get back to the area that I'm most concerned about, which is biomedical research. Because here we do have some looming threats that are much greater than any of the threats we've faced before. Much worse than the threat of terrorism, for example, which really mobilized this country after the 9/11 attacks and caused us to launch two wars and spend trillions of dollars on war and security. Well, there are some threats that are, that are threatening more people than that ever did. And so I'll give you an example, which is Alzheimer's disease. You know, the number of people age 65 and older with Alzheimer's disease is going to be 7 million in the next decade. It's going to rise 7 million. And that's a 40% rise from where we are now. And that's because of the demographics. The baby boomers are going to get older, and as they get older, their incidence of Alzheimer's disease is going to go way, way up.
And they're living longer.
Yes. Right? And the cost of taking care of people with Alzheimer's disease today is $200 billion a year. And that's going to be, it's going to be $1.2 trillion by mid-century per year. $1.2 trillion. That's what we spent on these wars every year. The amount of money we spend on research on Alzheimer's disease is a quarter of 1% of that $200 billion. So we spend a teeny, teeny amount of money to try to find a cure or to understand it better, and a lot of money on taking care of these people. And we make it nearly impossible for new people to come in with good ideas and do research on Alzheimer's disease.
Now, that seems surprising, because it seems there would be widespread popular support for the notion that this is a dreadful disease that we need to study. So why would there be an erosion of support for the research?
Because there's an erosion of support for all research. So right now, if most Alzheimer's disease research is supported by the National Institute of Aging, and they have the lowest pay line of all the institutes at the National Institutes of Health. Their pay line is somewhere between 7 and 10%. So that means that if you have a great idea and you want to work on Alzheimer's disease, you have about a 90% chance of being turned down from getting any funding to do that work. So there's something very strange about that picture, because I've really described to you a huge threat. One out of nine people over the age of 65 has Alzheimer's disease. So this is not a rare disease at all. It's a very common disease. And it's absolutely devastating, not just to the person who develops the disease, but to everybody in the circle of that person, every family member, everybody who's involved, and all of society, because the cost is so tremendous. So why are we doing this to ourselves? It's a self-inflicted injury that we are doing, and it's not just Alzheimer's, it's all across the board.
What about your area, the obesity, diabetes kind of research?
Yeah, we're in the midst of an unprecedented obesity and diabetes epidemic in the United States. There are about 24 million Americans who have type 2 diabetes, and that number is also going to rise a lot, because the number of people who have obesity and who are getting older is going up. But the same thing is true there. The chance of getting funded to study type 2 diabetes is in the 11% range. That's the pay line right now at the Institute of the NIH that funds this area. And so what's happened all across the board then is we have, it's like we're playing a bait and switch game with young people. We encourage people in high school to get into science. We think it's wonderful when Young people are interested in science. And when they go to college, we encourage them to volunteer in laboratories and get laboratory experience. And if they show talent, we encourage them to go to graduate school. So they spend maybe 5 or 6 years in graduate school, and they get a PhD degree. And then they go and they do postdoctoral work, which can be for 5, 8 years. So by that time, they've invested more than a decade of their life in research. And then they get a job that involves research. And then we throw them off a cliff because mm-hmm. their odds of getting supported to do that research plummets down to the odds that I just told you about, near the 10% range. In the meantime, there are countries that are doing exactly the opposite, because they saw what happened in the United States over the last half century. They saw that when we expanded this area, there were phenomenal spin-offs. There was a huge biotech revolution that occurred. A tremendous biotech industry evolved. We've gained an extraordinary understanding of many disease processes and many basic science processes. We know way more about how a cell works and fundamental processes of development and cell biology, and all of these are critical to understanding human disease. And so countries in Northern Europe and in Asia, Singapore, China, India, Scandinavian countries, and Germany are all putting huge resources to expand into research. The other consequence of our prior growth was that we were a magnet for the best and brightest scholars from other countries, most notably China and India. Some many, many very brilliant, very talented scholars from China and India came here and stayed here. And in a way, that's a subsidy to us. We created a brain drain out of those countries, and we were able to attract some of their most talented scholars who have contributed massively to science. Many of them are very entrepreneurial and developed a lot of they've been very inventive. Now we're turning them away, and they're going to these other countries that learned from us the value of basic science. So it's a self-inflicted wound, and other countries are going to benefit at our expense.
We're going to look further at this phenomenon of America's status as a can-do nation and whether it's eroding or not. And if it is, what can be done about it when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
Why does it matter that almost half the country rejects the overwhelming evidence of evolution, with or without the hand of God? After all, Americans are famously ignorant of many things, like where Iran is or when World War II took place, and we are still here. One reason is that rejecting evolution expresses more than an inability to think critically. It relies on a fundamentally paranoid worldview. Think what the world would have to be like for evolution to be false. Almost every scientist on Earth would have to be engaged in a fraud so complex and extensive it involved every field from archaeology, paleontology, geology, and genetics to biology, chemistry, and physics. That's from a recent article in The Nation. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Alan Addy, and we are talking about the erosion of popular support in America for science. This is a charged topic, evolution, creationism, and so on. But can you say something about how religion and science sometimes have been pitted against each other in ways that end up at the detriment of the kind of scientific inquiry that you are suggesting we need to do?
Yes, and the religion and science dichotomy, I have to say, it doesn't have to exist. It's a false dichotomy. Many scientists believe in God and go to church and synagogue and are believers in God, and it does not in any way preclude them from believing in evolution. So I don't feel like that is a necessary conflict. It's a necessary conflict only if you take a fundamentalist view that the Bible is a literal history of the world, and that no amount of scientific evidence can refute that. There's really no debate that can be had if you start from that premise, because it's basically writing off science and writing off evidence-based thinking. But the exciting thing about evolutionary biology is that that field is in a renaissance today, and that is the case for a lot of reasons. One is that there have been so many more fossils that have been found that fill in many of the so-called gaps. There's been great technology innovation that allows people to extract DNA from bones. And even though it's been degraded by the years, it's still possible to sequence that DNA. And that's now why we have Neanderthal DNA and Denisovan DNA sequenced, as well as many other extinct organisms. And so the DNA record is itself a molecular fossil record. And so many really exciting things have been discovered from looking at that molecular fossil record. But then every single day in the laboratory, you know, all of this information is publicly available on the internet. And so every scientist, every graduate student, every undergraduate student, any high school student can look up the DNA sequence of a gene from a giraffe or a gene from a bacterium and discover that bacteria and plants and giraffes have many genes in common because they have a common origin. And they themselves can line up the sequences and see that the phylogeny, the tree relationship that we know about, is completely reproduced in the DNA sequence. And so that level of detail that supports evolution is terrifically exciting and informative.
Is that where some of the money is going? If we're talking about the lack of support, government support, even popular support for sciences, what are the leaders in getting that support now?
Well, it's all, I mean, there's always been, and there still is, from the National Institutes of Health, an emphasis on disease-oriented research, on health-related research. And the NIH is divided into institutes based on disease area. And the funding approximately follows the relationship to mortality. So you can guess then that the National Cancer Institute is going to have a large amount of funding, and that the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute is going to have a lot of funding, because heart disease and cancer are the two greatest killers.
So why not Alzheimer's? Certainly everybody is aware of that. It may not be exactly what we think of as a killer,
everybody
knows about it by now.
Yes, relative to the others, it's still getting reasonable support, but the problem is that all of them have been cut.
And why? Well, I mean, you've given us a couple of reasons, but it doesn't seem to add up yet.
It is hard to understand. What happened is between 1998 and 2003, there was a doubling of the NIH budget. And so there was a wonderful expansion that occurred.
During two administrations, too, during
Bush administration. It started under Clinton, and it went partially into the Bush years. And then suddenly there was a huge cutback in the middle of the Bush administration. And then it continued and then got worse under Obama, except for 1 year where he had a one-time stimulus during the economic crisis. But there's been a steady decline, so that doubling has been completely undone. And now we're below the levels we were at before the doubling.
Well, what are the forces leading to that? Obviously, there must be something political behind it.
I think it coincided with tremendous amount. Well, first of all, the budget deficit swelled under the Bush administration for two major reasons. The wars, about $2 trillion, I believe it was, in the wars, and then about an equal amount of money in the tax cuts. So that created a tremendous deficit. And then as soon as Obama took over, the Republicans decided that that was the number one issue and that we needed to cut government spending. So science was a casualty of
and
that.
And politics, you know, you hear it come up a lot with debates over stem cell research and over the teaching of evolution and other stuff. To what extent has science become sort of a, I don't know, a hot potato between the political parties where some of these cuts are politically motivated?
It's confusing. I mean, I think that does occur once in a while, but I listened to the testimony of the NIH director, Francis Collins, that took place last May in front of the Senate committee that decides the NIH budget. It's a bipartisan group. And what impressed me the most was that all of the senators, both the Democrats and the Republicans, were gushing in their praise of the NIH and of all the extraordinary progress that has been made in many disease areas. They were very, very supportive. And so I couldn't understand how that could be the case. And then there's essentially no move to do something about this budget crisis. And Collins did say that we're losing a whole generation of scientists. And I have to say that I'm seeing it now. I see many, many young people who are among the best, the most talented, the most brilliant people we see coming through, who look at the stress that we're under, where we're under existential threat every time we renew our grants, and where all of our staff is imperiled with unemployment after all these years. And they look at that and they say, why do I want to do that? I don't want to do that. And they walk away. And so we see many young people who spent all those years of training and who were so excited about being involved in basic science research, walking away from it and pursuing other careers.
And do you think part of it is that there's a growing private sector involvement, whether it's pharmaceutical companies or, let's say, the grape juice company Welch's funding research on whether, red grapes promote long life and so on? Is there a greater involvement of the corporate side in research than there used to be?
Now, well, as a proportion of the whole, yes, but pharmaceutical companies have cut way back in basic research. And what happened with the pharmaceutical industry is that it's become consolidated. 15 years ago, there were about 25 large pharmaceutical companies in
this
country.
Some less competition.
And so what's happened is that they consolidated, and mainly they did so in search of, they would buy a company because it had one profitable product. So when Pfizer bought Park Davis, they bought it because they had Lipitor, and they wanted Lipitor. And then they killed the rest of the rest of the company. They killed the pipelines. And now Pfizer, now that the Lipitor patent has run out, Pfizer has contracted tremendously and fired more than 10,000 of their employees. And they've closed down their R&D. They closed down their R&D in Sandwich, England, which was a very big plant. And they're closing down their plant in Groton, Connecticut. And they're cutting back on basic science because it doesn't generate short-term profit. And so for them, it's a lot easier to look around at small biotech or other companies that might develop something. And then when it looks like it's ripe and promising, they go buy it. But the consequence of that is there's a dry pipeline, fewer leads, fewer promising cures on the horizon for many disease areas, especially the ones that aren't the big tickets like Alzheimer's that affect fewer people. So all over, there's been a decrease in support, both in industry and in the public sector for basic research. I think another dynamic is that it's very hard to explain to people who are not in science that the great discoveries in science and the ones that have the greatest impact on people's lives are not the ones that were intended to do that. because we really don't know what something is going to be relevant to until much later.
Can you give us some examples of these sort of unexpected, like a basic research thing that led to something else?
Well, I can give an example from here in Madison. We all were lucky enough to have a brilliant scientist on our campus, Howard Temin, who was very interested in understanding how RNA viruses replicate. And he came out with the radical idea, he and another scientist named David Baltimore, that contrary to what was then considered the central dogma that DNA is transcribed to RNA and RNA is translated into protein, and that could only occur in one direction, he said, well, maybe RNA can get transcribed back into DNA, and that these RNA viruses integrate their DNA by making a DNA from an RNA template. And it was highly controversial at the time, but it wasn't aimed at any disease because there was no human disease caused by those kinds of viruses at that time. Nobody knew of any human disease caused by those kinds of viruses. Well, there were two enormously important outcomes of that. One is that the enzyme that he discovered, reverse transcriptase, is used every single day in just about every molecular biology laboratory because it's central to the ability to clone genes. So it had a technological impact. But perhaps more importantly, 10 or 12 years after that, the AIDS epidemic emerged. And HIV is a retrovirus. It's a virus of the type that Howard Temin was studying. And so it was because of those discoveries that the virus could be identified. There was a way to screen blood for it. And there are now treatments for it that have allowed people who are infected to lead nearly naturally long lifespans when before it was a complete death sentence.
So when you say basic science and how basic science is losing support, you mean science that isn't geared towards solving a particular problem or a known problem, but rather just more a matter of scientific curiosity?
Yes. Yes, that's right. And, you know, it's interesting and scary to do a thought exercise and to ask, what would have happened if instead of emerging in 1981, the AIDS epidemic had emerged in 1950.
No science to deal with it.
And at that time, the field of virology was very primitive. There weren't techniques for isolating viruses and characterizing them. We did not know how DNA replicates. The whole field of molecular biology emerged after that. And so it would have been very difficult to know what was the infectious agent. We wouldn't have even known how to know what it is. And we have a partial answer to what would have happened because we have South Africa, mm-hmm. where there was a president who denied that HIV causes AIDS and stood in the way of a lot of public health measures. And one quarter of the population of South Africa is HIV positive. Well, think about what would happen in the entire world if there was no way to screen for it, no way to make to clean up the blood supply and make it safe, and no way to know what it is that we're trying to protect against. What percent of the population would have come down with HIV and there'd be no treatment? So it would have been like the Great Plague. Maybe it would have killed a third or a quarter or maybe half the world. It's a scary thought.
Yeah.
And yet there have been several books written about the next plague. What's going to happen when some other horrible virus...
Seems inevitable, doesn't it?
It seems inevitable. And what are we going to do?
Is one of the problems with the funding for research that research has gotten so much more expensive, just like medicine? In other words, back a half century ago, where maybe research in genetics might have been getting some fruit flies and doing some studies, now you've got these high-tech sort of equipment that you need. And in medicine, you know, you've got all these heart-lung transplants and all the machines that go with that, all the computerized things. I mean, to do research, is more expensive than it used to be, right?
Yes, absolutely. It's way more expensive. But right now, the entire budget of the NIH costs $94 a year per American taxpayer for everything, for the entire, you know, for all of biomedical research. And that doesn't just pay for research. It supports and subsidizes most universities in the country, most research-based universities. And the reason for that is that universities charge indirect costs on top of every grant, and that is what they use to subsidize many activities that occur that make the university a good place to do research. Now, that has had enormous consequences on the priorities of universities, and that's why many universities have expanded their dedication to scientific research, because it pays the bills. But with this contraction, it's causing a real crisis. And, you know, one of the things that we now see is that universities are strapped for money, and so they're raising tuition. And as they're, during this time when there was an expansion of science, there was also a pullback in, for example, in state universities, in state support for universities. For example, in the University of Wisconsin, 40 years ago, the state provided about 49% of the budget of the university, and now that number is down around 12 or 13%. And so tuition used to be manageable for most citizens, including people of modest means. They could come in, get a job at the cafeteria, and graduate without debt because they were paying $250 a semester for tuition back in the 1970s. Now tuition is 20 times higher than that, and it's become out of reach for many students. So I think there's been this indirect effect of universities depending more and more on the science grants and the overhead that that brings in, and then when that becomes unstable, it causes university budgets to become unstable, and one of the casualties is students having to pay more tuition.
Let's look a little more closely at grants and where they come from and what the priorities with those are when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Alan Addy, who is telling us about the plight of American science and scientific ingenuity and curiosity, the money drying up from government sources, the money even, you tell us, drying up from grants, and yet we really would like to come back to this notion that we had 50 years ago where America does things in science because they're difficult and not because there's necessarily an immediate dollar and cent effect to them. So how, under these circumstances, Alan, can we get back to that track?
Well, I think we need two things. It's a really exciting time to do science because our capabilities are so great. We have technology advances in microscopy that allow us to see things in living cells that we were not able to see before. And we have the ability to look at all the proteins in the cell, all the genes in the nucleus, and see things that at a level and depth that we could never do before. But it costs money to do that. But not a lot more. And that's the thing that's so frustrating about this, is that what it cost to close down the government last fall when there was a government shutdown was $26 billion. That was a five-day government shutdown. That alone would just about double the NIH budget. That's it.
Five days where the government shutdown.
Five days of not doing something.
Yeah. So we're not talking about something on the scale of starting a war and spending $1 trillion. It's way, way, way less than that. But the other thing that we need is to go back to the sense of ourselves that Kennedy invoked and appealed to in 1961 and 1962, which is this concept of being a can-do nation, the idea that we are confronting some very challenging scientific problems and that we want to take on these challenges because they're hard, just the way he said it. And I crave to have a leader say that to the American people and appeal to our sense of self and our willingness to take on a difficult problem. It would be amazing if we had a leader who would look at the Alzheimer's crisis that's looming, for example, and say, let's do something about this. Let's really take it on. And also to take on the more subtle point that's more difficult to sell and more difficult to explain, that it's not about targeting a disease, that we don't know if somebody who is ostensibly working on Alzheimer's is going to come up with the breakthrough that could really help Alzheimer's. It could very well come from somebody studying protein transport in yeast. And in fact, the Nobel Prize this year was given to a scientist, Randy Shechtman, who made some of the greatest and most fundamentally important discoveries in how proteins are processed and folded and transported through a cell. And Alzheimer's disease is a disease of aberrant protein folding, protein misfolding. So, and Shechtman was not studying Alzheimer's disease, but he laid the foundation for other people. And so we need to expand and conquer these areas, but we need to not tell people that they have to be working in those diseases because we just don't know where the breakthrough is going
to
come from.
So back to basic science.
Yes.
Do you think scientists need to do a better job of articulating their craft and its, I guess, its impact on the public? In other words, because science and medicine have become so specialized, sometimes scientists in one field can't even understand scientists in another. You know, the terminology is increasingly complex. If you want the public to sort of buy in to the idea of more tax dollars going towards science, it seems to me there's a need to explain what you're trying to explain, which is that sometimes basic research in a lab on something that can seem esoteric can translate later into something that keeps your husband alive longer.
Oh, absolutely true. And I think you're doing a great job getting the word out in a program like this. But when you look outside of public radio and public television, you don't see topics like this being discussed in an uninterrupted way for a full hour. When you go to, you know, commercial media outlets, it's sound bites. And so how in the world can somebody have a chance to explain a difficult topic or go through showing diagrams of a process in a sound bite? It just isn't, and it's a hard sell. And it's difficult to get the word out in
well,
that way.
Well, 2014 is the year that the United States gets out of Afghanistan. We're already out of Iraq. So that is theoretically at least a windfall, a considerable windfall in the next few years to come. Is this a time when there would be lobbying, and who would do it on behalf of basic science?
Well, you're pointing out another problem, yet another problem, and another dramatic change in American politics, and that's the role of money in politics. We do have lobbies in Washington. There are scientific organizations that lobby the American Diabetes Association, the American Cancer Society, the Muscular Dystrophy Foundation. There are many organizations that champion individual diseases and the people who are suffering from them. But they don't have a lot of money, and they can't spend large amounts of money on people's political campaigns. That's not what they're about.
Right.
But now we have a situation where people in Congress are constantly in fundraising mode. and where you pay to play, where, you know, the amount of money that's needed to get the ear of a congressperson is way more than it used to be. So I feel like we've been a little bit disenfranchised. It's much harder for science to have a voice. We've lost some of our greatest champions, including several Republicans. Lowell Weicker was a Republican senator from Connecticut and was a very, very strong advocate of biomedical research funding. And he's gone. And so, on the other side, Tom Harkin from Iowa is about to retire, and that's going to be a big loss. So we need more. And actually, Newt Gingrich was won over by scientific organizations appealing to him, taking him on laboratory tours, and he became a big advocate for science and supported the doubling of the NIH budget in the 1990s. So we need to return to that, but it's become harder.
Well, where to begin?
How much of it needs to focus early on with the teaching of science in the schools and the sort of portrayal of the role of science and scientists?
It's critically important, but the what's different about the United States from many other countries in the world is that we have such a highly decentralized educational system. And so it's very balkanized, and every state sets its standards, and there are battles in every state legislature about what gets taught, not just in science, but also in other subject areas. There are very famous battles in the Texas Board of Education that I'm sure you've heard about, where they don't just argue about whether or not creationism should be taught, but they argue about whether or not kids should learn about Thomas Jefferson. Even that's controversial.
Well, I've seen that the statistics are really alarming in terms of American school children's knowledge of math and science compared to their counterparts in other countries, that we have children with the highest self-esteem but really low test scores in math and science.
Yeah, I think there it has to do with attracting teachers and paying them well. And in other countries, teaching is considered a really noble profession. In Finland, for example, that's the country most people cite when they talk about that. There are many more people who want to teach than there are teaching jobs. They get paid well. They have a very prestigious place in society. I wish we would honor teachers more and make it a more attractive profession with better pay and better conditions. I think part of the problem is the way schools are run. Many teachers just don't feel like they have enough autonomy. So there are a lot of cultural issues in the way we have such a decentralized school system and the way that they're managed.
Well, we'll hope that there will be some catalyst, preferably not a crisis, that will reverse this trend and get us back to this concept that basic science is something worth pursuing, worth investing in. Alan Addy, thank you for joining us for this hour.
Thank you for inviting me.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.